Welcome to our second episode of the Stanford Healthcare AI water cooler discussions. And I'm Justin Norden, a Stanford faculty and co-founder of Qualified Health. We have Matthew Lundgren, our other co-host, who's Chief Scientific Officer for Microsoft Health and also on Stanford faculty. And we're thrilled to be joined by Dr. Graham Walker, who is also a Stanford Medicine proud
Former Stanford
alum.
faculty.
Former. We'll get you
Former
back.
Stanford faculty, perfect.
Who's also co-directs the Advanced Technology Group for Kaiser Permanente, which is all the advanced technology, AI, and new things coming. And he's also the founder of MDCalc, who I'm sure many people have used, a new company called OffCall, and many other things. So thank you, Graham, so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, guys. Yeah, good to be back on the virtual farm, as it were.
This counts. So for today, I mean, so from our first episode, we had a ton of great responses, some comments about some technical things, some things that people wanted to see us cover. And as you know, this is really meant to be kind of a conversation that reflects the ones that we have when we're not on camera and recording. We have a few topics today, and then we'll kind of get into just some general discussion about what we're seeing today. So we're going to talk a little about GPT 4.5, kind of one of the newer models that have hit the scene, although we have a bunch, and then we'll talk about the bunch as well. We kind of have a paralysis by choice at this point with so many different models to choose from. And then we'll talk about some new data that's coming out around physicians and their use of both the public models and even some of the solutions that have been deployed into practice. And get folks' take. And there's just a few odds and ends, some headlines that have come our way that have raised a lot of discussions, one around some proposals around regulation and maybe even new capabilities for AI models, prescribing capabilities, which is kind of an interesting idea. And we'll get everyone's reaction.
Sounds good. Well, should we start with some of the new capabilities?
Yeah, let's do it. I think maybe it's worth it. And Graham, feel free to chime in on this.
Yeah.
I just wanted to just a level set. Well, so for those of you who aren't familiar with the lore behind the TechZ unicorn, this is Sebastian Bubick. Harkens back to a paper he wrote, Sparks of AGI, basically paper, the original GPT-4, which surprised a lot of people that the model was able to put together, as you can see in the middle, something that resembles a unicorn. Again, this was a language model. This was a shocking result back in 2022, and obviously a leap from 3.5. So to in the recent 4.5 sort of evaluations, he posted the new kind of updated impression of a TechZ unicorn, just to give a visual sense. But if you actually look at some of the data around the model's performance, again, we're not seeing this massive leap, but remember that some of these benchmarks are, relatively close to saturation in certain areas. I think for some of these simple ones, some important things to take away. We're used to these huge jumps, right, between 3 to 4, and we're seeing, some maybe somewhat incremental or slowing improvement. And this is really reflective, I think, of the pre-training, the traditional approach to pre-training, the scaling laws of, exponential input for somewhat linear improvement. So these models get bigger and bigger, they become harder and harder to make, quote unquote, smarter. But we have some other things to work with in test time compute. But on the right-hand side, which is I'm really excited about, which is that, the hallucination rate, which does tend to limit or really force you to build a lot of scaffolding around applications, off the shelf, is starting to look quite a bit better. And I think a lot of people would agree when they're using the models. I don't know, Graham or Justin, if you've been playing with any of these newer models and noticing that, the stuff that you used to pick up all the time, this thing was wrong or this seemed off, it's starting to look a little bit better.
I mean, Matthew, I'm a little surprised that it still is 37%. I'm not super familiar with the simple QA data set, but I mean that still seems way higher. I think there's probably two things going on. People are more comfortable with the LLM responses, and so they're probably checking them less, to be completely honest. Like they, these things have met some sort of acceptable criteria for humans to start using and trusting. I mean, I think, Google's partly to blame for that too, right? I mean, they've just been embedding them in all your search terms. I mean, often I'm now seeing, like, if I'm like getting in an argument with a friend will send me the Google answer, but it's not the Google answer. It's the Google AI answer. And that's not really the same thing. You know, it used to be, oh yeah, here's the screenshot of the fact from the web page, or it's from the from census.gov. Nope, it's now the screenshot. And I don't know if my friends know that they're sending an AI version, or if they are just implicitly trusting them, but that's the thing. Like, we've reached some level where people are just implicitly trusting these things. I'm not sure that humanity should be trusting them just yet, but it seems like we're there.
Yeah,
there's there's a trust but verify, I think, too. Like, at least for those of us that use them all the time, and in this metacognition thing, right, where you're sort of like, okay, I know it's going to get me like 80% of the way there, but it's still going to save me some time. But the worst part of this is what we would call sort of the GPT slop, right? I think which by the way, I think was in the running for the term of the year last year, Webster's Dictionary new term. But that's where, like, I mean, I've gotten to the point, I think there's been some data on this, where I can read, you know, some of these posts and kind of say, ah, that looks like a Claude, or that looks like a GPT-4 to me. And you could tell there's not a lot of effort put into the editing.
Well, this is the thing I want to pull up that kind of brings both of those things together, which is, one, there are so many of these models out now, or like, what's changed in 2 years, right? Versus, oh my gosh, look at these capabilities, they've come out. You know, one, there's so many models out there now and competition for that, Graham, to your point, the companies are just embedding the AI capabilities in their native applications, which lots of people thought would come. And the reason to do that is to keep people on the platform, and it's a way to compete with others. And so there are so many of these models out there, you know, for I guess most of us and people listening, it's reminiscent of the old search pages where you'd use Alta Vista and Ask Jeeves and just a long list of companies where you'd ask multiple times to try to get to your answer before, you know, Google really kind of won out. And as we're looking at these models, a question that, like, I get all the time is like, well, what model do I use for what? And the challenging part of that is it's changing every few weeks, right? It's not just GPT 4.5 that came out. It's Claude 3.7 just came out, and there's new models every couple of weeks. And so that's changing. But the interesting thing to me, at least, is it seems like this is moving to a world where there's going to be multiple models to choose from, both for a consumer, both for companies, both for healthcare organizations. And so, you know, when I think about it, you know, how do you set yourselves up to use multiple different things and to be able to access multiple different things is something that, you know, I think is super important. But curious, Matt, Graham, what do you guys think about that? What are you using for yourself?
What you're sharing on the screen is, I was just doing the back of the napkin, that's about $300 a month of subscriptions, right?
Of tools, yeah.
Assuming you're not paying the $200 a month for OpenAI Pro.
For the Pro. Yeah, I'm mostly using ChatGPT and Claude. ChatGPT tends to give me answers that are a bit more unique. And then I'm using Claude really around more editing capability. When I want feedback on my writing, but I don't want my writing to change as much, ChatGPT is more than happy to to tell me that, oh, I love this article that you just wrote, and then rewrite it in its own words. And, you know, it's like both complimenting me, but also it's like a backhanded compliment that it's redone the whole thing because it wasn't that good. Versus Claude typically will stick with my own words and then try to clean them up, make them a little bit more cohesive without changing as much. So those are the two I'm using the most. I've played around with DeepSeek a fair amount. I found that DeepSeek, like when I've just been testing DeepSeek will like let you get away with more stuff, and it'll be a little bit more, allow a little bit more devious behavior, which is probably a fact because it's, you know, open source and not as, you know, the weights are all open. So I imagine they probably have to allow more of that. And I think that's the testing that I've seen as well. Like, you can get DeepSeek to tell you how to rob a bank much easier than you can Claude or ChatGPT or some of the other kind of closed models.
Have you tried them all? Like, I mean, that you still practice, right? Do you ever you know, throw in and just see if it comes up with a differential that seems reasonable? Do you ever, you know, do that or talk to the model even?
The differentials are always reasonable. They So far, they've, and I'm excited to try out 4.5. Matthew, if you want to give me access. The models all have some gap that still makes me very leery to rely on them. I think they're content generation, so they're great for generating a differential, but I'm not yet convinced that they're going to be a comprehensive differential or that the number one thing is always going to be the correct one at the top. If you and then you add one more complicating factor, like, oh, it's a kid or it's a pregnant patient or something like that, and then they start to show a little bit more of their challenges, I think. But again, growth mindset, these things are every year, these things are, getting better and better, and it's harder and harder to find those areas where they're not as good.
Yeah, I remember when 3.5 came out, like you'd see these viral threads, like it's super simple, medical questions. It'd be, wildly off base. And like I said, I mean, obviously I use it all the time. Part of some red teaming work and things, and it's increasingly hard. In fact, it actually stretches some of your own medical knowledge, and then you have to go back to the source. Like, that sounds right, but I need to double check. And that kind of gets me to deep research. And I don't know if you've played with those, Graham or Justin, but like, I've had moments of just like almost just like the initial GPT moment with deep research, where I'm like, this is a game changer. And then there'll be times when like, it's a pretty superficial read of some of the content, but you know where this is headed. I mean, to your point, this is the worst it'll ever be. That kind of thing you hear said a lot. But if you talk about access to all of your journals and all the, all the things that we subscribe to and like our medical libraries, now you're talking, right? I mean, that could be pretty powerful. And I don't know if you've used these and kind of tested out with topics that really well to kind of get a sense of how close it is.
Well, speaking of medical journals and access, there's a recent announcement, a headline, Open Evidence just raised a boatload of money. And they claimed, I think, 25% of physicians were now using the tool. Kind of in my head, I think about it as an up-to-date, competitor of being able to ask open-ended questions, cite this with real research, reduce that hallucination rate. Which was something that came up before, drop that down where, initially when people were asking questions with GPT-4, I was like, oh my gosh, look at all these citations. Then you look at the citations and they were all made up. But, as the scaffolding, I think that, Matt talked about before around these models where you constrain what they're able to look through to only be able to produce certain things. It's not just that the models are getting better. Basically, as software developers, and I feel like this is actually something a lot of people miss when they're talking about, at least in healthcare, of people who aren't maybe familiar with the technology. It's like, oh, did the models just get better? It's like, that is one aspect of how these tools are getting better. We're also getting a lot better as, engineers for how to use them and use them in a way that actually produces meaningful results. And so that's just an example, recently of something that has really kind of gained a lot of traction in the last few months and years.
Yeah,
Yeah, I
Graham,
agree.
oh, I was going to say, Graham, have you ever tried to throw in prompt to like this, say Claude or something, and just say create an MD Calc from scratch? Like, have you ever tried that?
Totally, yeah. And it's there are some calculators that it's been able to do really well, and there's others that it's like, ooh, this is dangerously bad because it's gonna, I mean, that's the other thing that I think about a lot is it's that level of trust. I mean, it's the Google embedding it in search results thing that I do worry that even with hallucination rates going down and scaffolding getting better, and you could feed the model back to itself and verify that the answer is that the model thinks the model is accurate. I still do worry that like somebody is going to make a decision based on an LLM piece of information that is maybe it's not wrong, but it's just not comprehensive, and they do not have the training or the experience to know that, oh, yeah, usually you can give that drug. In this particular circumstances, that was a really bad idea. And, either the model gave you the wrong information or you didn't give the model enough information for the model to give you the right answer. I mean, take pregnant patients, for some reason, I'm thinking about digoxin toxicity and like, giving them calcium and stone heart, which I think has mostly been debunked, but still, like you can imagine, a human doctor is going to have, it's going to try to take in all the pieces of information and then take an action. But if you're just giving it the two-liner from your H&P, that's often not sufficient information to give a right answer to.
Yeah, and I think the usage is interesting, but one thing actually that has come up before and through a ton of conversations, Graham, to argue the other side, as compared to what? So sure. Are there going to be AI misses? Yes, yes, and yes. You know, often it'll come up and usually they're overblown, but you always hear the media headlines of look how many mistakes physicians make, you know, and you know, now we're starting to see the articles of patients working with AI to get the diagnosis that the doctor missed. How do you think what should we compare, you know, that AI against, you know, or even for yourself? How are you comparing it for yourself for when and where you should use these tools?
Yeah, it's I think of the Tesla full driving capability thing where I don't really know that it feels ethically, because it's like the loss of control, that these tools need to be not just as good, not just 1 point better than the average human driver. Because you can always argue that the average human driver may have hit the brake fast enough or something like that. Like it does feel, because you're losing the control factor, it feels like they need to be at the 99.9th percentile of the best driver in the world. You know, and then the other thing I always think about is to your point, Justin, we can't think about risk of tools in a vacuum. We have to think of total risk, right? I mean, it's like when I give somebody a blood transfusion, I tell them your risk of walking across the street after I get you feeling better and you get hit by a bus is way higher than your risk of HIV or hepatitis C, which are, of course, the two most common things that people worry about, but they're like one in a million, one in 10 million. And so you have to think about all the risk. And certainly the other risk is, you know, patients waiting 6 months to see a cardiologist because there's a backlog to get seen. And the patients are going to get sicker in that time. So I think we do have to think about, consider all the risk and not just think about the risks of AI or just think about the risks of humans, but like think about the risks of being a patient in American healthcare, you know?
Yeah. The interesting thing that I want to make sure we get to here on people using these tools and how and why, you brought this up a little bit, but this was a recent survey. The AMA published, you know, a second generation of kind of AI use, and they call AI use, interestingly, not artificial intelligence, they call it augmented intelligence,
yeah,
but across clinicians. And this number was shocking to me. You know, before, and it seemed to be, you know, around a third of, you know, clinicians were using AI in their practice. Now that jumped to two thirds. the context I'm always still, you know, shocked by this is two thirds of clinicians are using this. Most work settings haven't given people access to these tools. And so it's just this amazing, it's amazing things. And Graham, I know we've talked about this before,
yeah,
but it's like people are going around and using phones, using other things. But what do you make of this?
I would love to see if this trend is true in other countries. I tend to assign a lot of the things that we see in the US as due to our very dysfunctional healthcare system. And so like I see the rapid adoption here as a sign of like doctors in the US are really struggling to keep up with all of the stuff, whether it's clinical or administrative or prior auth or anything like that. So I would be fascinated to know if this trend is an international trend. Is the UK, I mean, every country's physicians and nurses and, you know, healthcare workers in the whole world are struggling. Many are quitting. Many med students across the world don't want to practice at the bedside. So it could be that this is, you know, a wide trend, or it could be like American medicine is particularly bad, and so doctors are way more likely to use these in the US than other places.
I mean, I feel like we talked a little bit about this last time, Justin, too, which was the sort of British Medical Journal had a paper on surveying GPs and the NHS, and, you know, they weren't quite as, you know, granular as maybe what I'm seeing here, and they were actually focusing on just the public APIs, like basically the public models that you'd have, you know, put on your phone. And And I think the surprising result, that we talked about, which I think is echoed here, but just I can't quite match the results there to here as well, because I'm assuming some of these are, software that was sold, from vendors that have vetted the capabilities. But, I guess almost a third of these docs were using it for what you would consider a medical device, right? Something that would be a clinical decision support device. And that, that's surprising, but also at the same time, not, right? Like of course they are. Like, you know what I mean? At some level, to your point, they're stressed, they're working through things, and maybe they're finding these tools useful. I'm hearing stories of folks are literally just kind of using the voice mode around in ER settings, urgent cares, and basically kind of almost doing a like you would when you were an intern or a resident presenting the case, and then getting feedback. And I've heard other stories of folks hoping to have one of them on the pod because they're doing a study on this. But remember, in the old when we were in med school, at least when I was, it was kind of a novel idea to bring an infectious disease or a a pharmacist actually with you on rounds, particularly in ICU, to look at the huge list of meds we're putting patients on and give feedback, right? And now a similar thing is happening, but they're literally wheeling around GPT basically, right? And sort of having it listen into the discussion and then make comments. I just think it's a fascinating idea. And again, just kind of brings the point of maybe we don't know how to practice medicine and take advantage of these tools in the best way yet,
Yeah, it's still very, very early days.
What's interesting about that, though, is this one other slide, and then I promise I'll put away some of the AMA data here. But the definite advantage group, to me, is what I'm tracking in my head. Obviously, scribing has gained a ton of momentum, over the past couple of years as these tools have gotten better. And there's still, a mixed, people have different opinions for how helpful or where it's helpful and things like that. But there are certain people who swear by it now. And there are certain people, right, who started to use these other AI tools that are absolutely seeing advantage. I've talked to former students who've taken, our generative AI medicine course who are using these things all the time, and they think they save just from the public tools where they're trying not to put in any patient information, a couple hours a day, when they were an intern, because it helped with discharge summaries, planning tough conversations with patients, looking up current evidence and things like this. And so the reason I track this kind of definite advantage group is it's kind of a bellwether for kind of what's to come. There's always this kind of curve of adoption of technology. But when you track that group and people are absolutely seeing the benefits, to me, it just says it's a matter of time before this gets more widespread. And that's one of the things that, yeah, again, this is the worst it will be. And so we're really already seeing benefits that if you scale it to the issues that Graham was talking about around burnout issues, people leaving medicine, it has started to at least give me some hope.
I think we need to have more people sharing how they're using them. I mean, Matthew, I'd never heard of that, like a virtual AI pharmacist idea. Love it. I think there's so many ways that these tools can be used that people just aren't thinking about. I mean, I was showing my mom, like, oh, you could like talk to it in Spanish. Like, you want to practice your Spanish? Just ask it to do super beginner Spanish with you, and then it'll just do it. And she hadn't even thought of that as a possibility. I had like a I had a challenging palliative care discussion with a patient in the ED, and I like the day later it was still bugging me. I was like, God, could I have done that better? And so I kind of described, without of course PHI or details, I described like how the patient and their family was feeling and what I was trying to convey. And I said, hey, can you pretend to be this family member? Be the daughter of my patient. And then I'm going to talk to you. And then when I say, that's a wrap or something, let's pause and like give me feedback. How did I do? And so there are just, I shout out Stanford did my simulation medicine training there, but like there's so many ways we could use these tools outside of just clinical medicine. Think about simulation, think about difficult, conversations with patients, breaking bad news, AI pharmacist. I heard somebody, a guy at Yale, is using a bridge with med students and having the med student write their own note having a bridge write the note, and then they have to critique what they liked about their note versus a bridge's and why. And why did a bridge include that here in the HPI, but you put it in social history? Like, there are ways we can use these tools not to replace us, but to teach and educate and help us for sure.
Yeah, the education topic is one that, you know, I'm surprised I don't hear more often. I mean, you brought up the really, really important use case, which is the empathetic coaching. There's been a few papers on this. Yeah. I think that's a phenomenal use case, right? We don't, first of all, we don't get that many turns of bat, thankfully, in a lot of our, you know, specialties, except for obviously palliative care or something where, you know, we would get seminars from folks in palliative care who do this as experts, and they would come and give us some, you know, some tips on how we can have these hard discussions with patients. But, you know, hearing it a couple of times, maybe reading some, but then actually when you're standing there having to have that discussion, man, I would almost take any sort of life preserver to help me, you know, coach up for those kinds of discussions. And, but on the education topic, there's been some phenomenal papers that just aren't really getting a lot of attention. And I'm surprised by one. I don't know if Justin, you have that one that was, it was a news article that recently talked about a school in Nigeria that used GPT-4 just as a tutor, and two grade levels of advancement within like a 6-week intervention, which is insane to me. And then obviously, just like you, I mean, you talked about your mom, my daughter takes Japanese, and her, you know, we obviously live in Palo Alto, so everyone's thinking about GPT anyway, but her teacher just said to the students straight up, you need to be practicing your Japanese conversation with, you know, the advanced voice mode of one of these models. And I think that in, you know, it's been just tremendous. I wonder whether there's a medical equivalent. You mentioned a couple of use cases. I remember back in the day, we used to just go through question banks for the step.
Yeah.
But these models, as I think Nigam Shah's group showed, can actually write, you know, step questions that are indistinguishable from real ones. And actually when you score the people on them, it's equivalent, right? So it really is a phenomenal study aid. Again, I feel like there's a lot, maybe this is going on again under the covers and we're just not hearing as much about it, but we're just, it's early, I feel like, is what I end up concluding.
The other thing I'll just call out, a few from students have come up over the years from learning, just explaining concepts.
Yeah.
Hey, explain the Krebs cycle to me. No. Explain it like I'm an eighth grader. No. Explain it like I'm six.
Yeah.
And you get these different reps and versions of these concepts that these models, right, have, you know, an inherent ability to kind of tackle from different perspectives. Like, that's what an expert teacher does. They have such a good grasp of the material, they can get six different ways to explain it. And like, that's what these models can do. And to Graham, your point before, people are still just learning these different ways to interact. And what's scary to me, kind of seeing this, is when I hear students' use of these models, they're all across the spectrum. Some are using these models 10 hours a day in their learning. It's always on, transcribing lectures, summarizing lectures, asking questions, translating teaching. Others are barely using them at all. And the gaps of just what people can do and understand with these models, that alarms me a little bit, especially when we see how much more some people can get done with them. And so and that's part of the reason we're doing this is, hey, great. Maybe Graham's going to try advanced voice mode on rounds with a pharmacist next time, or people are going to kind of get ideas for ways to do this, but hopefully people will do so safely. I'll just disclaimer.
I hope the models get smart enough to tell the student, you don't need to know the Krebs cycle. It's all a scam. You'll never use it again.
I mean, Matthew, that's part of the, that's part of this. I have this idea that these models will be, if we train them appropriately without misinformation, like, these models will be kind of more objective arbiters of the truth, and they may actually drive us to reform the medical education curriculum. I mean, why were we all taught the brachial plexus? Not just that it exists, but like the cords and the, I don't even know, right? I remember memorizing those, and I remember a bunch of mnemonics to memorize them, but why do I need to know how those lines connect and then overlap and cross? I don't know. I don't think either of you could answer either, but it's part of tradition. But, you know, have you guys seen one of the you know, first aid for step one now? It is at least twice as thick as when I bought it in 2004 or something like that. I mean, it's insane how much more they have to memorize. And I mean, I thought it was bad enough to have to answer like stuff about cyclic GMP, but now it's so much worse that like it may, these tools may force humans to kind of disrupt some of our tradition and be like, oh, what, well, it's important that people know that where the nerves run in the body, but do they need to know the way that the brachial plexus connects? Maybe not. The Krebs cycle, it's important to know that that thing exists. I think it does like oxidative phosphorylation, or is that the other one?
That's,
but anyway,
yeah.
Anyway, like we need to know what that is because, you know, aspirin overdoses block that. But besides that, do you need to have memorized the whole thing? It's like a running joke, you know?
Totally. Well, I will say that, well, there's two, I feel like I have two minds on this. One is like, I feel like we are LLMs in some, like, if we want to use this analogy, and we have to do some pre-training, right? So there's some just like exercising the muscle like that we do. I sort of still am, you know, happy with the way that we at least attempt to get as much information. It forces you to become someone that can absorb vast amounts of information, process it, and still be able to, you know, manipulate the concepts. There's something to that, right? I think in terms of just as being able to functionally keep up, to your point, with the acceleration. But there's also this idea of skill atrophy, which is kind of real. I mean, you know, I haven't used a map in 20 years. I probably could barely find my way outside of my neighborhood anymore without a GPS. And so that's real too. How much does that impact me? Not maybe as much. Am I more efficient? Sure. So there's got to be some balance here, but where that is, I don't know. But I do agree though, to your point, that the medical education system, just like all the rest of, I would say, the traditional education system, is kind of staring into this and wondering, what does this really mean for them?
And with that said, there have been people have been asking this question about medical education for a long time. And, you know, I'll give a shout out to Dr. Charles Prober, who flipped the classroom, did a lot at Stanford and really across the nation. And we've had the internet and ways to get access to raw memorization. Let's have people apply this information through cases, learn in the classroom together to do that. And so to me, this is just a supercharging of those concepts, which is, let's get people more into, you know, real simulated situations, whether simulated with AI, and use AI to kind of advance it. It just kind of really accelerates that. Maybe the one last topic to call out before we wrap is, you know, there was a bill proposed on AI being allowed to prescribe. Matt, I'll start with you. You wanted to go through this, like, walk us through what it was and what you think is going to happen.
Well, I mean, I think that, so this isn't the first time, but this one did catch headlines, I think, just given the kind of current conversation around AI and healthcare and all these things that I think are starting to be more mainstream. But I guess the general thought is that a model, it could legally prescribe a medication. And I don't, you know exactly how you'd even really implement that per se, just given how things would work. But I can imagine a scenario where there's some confined scope of certain medications, where almost like you're starting to see with some of these apps, right, that are kind of willing and fairly, I guess they kind of loosen the rules in terms of how deep you need to go with your medical history and your physician to actually get a medication that's common, right? But I think it's something to that effect. But now imagine you could have your app also has this ability to then literally prescribe a medication after, you know, interaction. Again, I don't see this passing, but I always look for these kinds of signals that are kind of like that, what, you know, Ethan Mollick calls the jagged edge, the jagged frontier, right, of where the capabilities are starting to meet some real world impact that has pretty big ramifications if we let it continue.
I do think the regulations that require, the same traditions of medical education are the same legacies of like medical licensure. I mean, the fact that we all need a California license, and if we drive to Nevada, we need a Nevada license. I think those structures are starting to break down. I would love to have a hospital be able to prescribe, like have a hospital owning the risk. And yeah, if the hospital wants to use an AI to do that, give the hospital a license to prescribe medicines or to dispense medicines or something. And I agree, Matthew, the If you look at many of the telehealth providers, what are those prescribers doing? They are, as fast as possible, clicking boxes that have already been evaluated and checked by the patient, which then have routed through an algorithm to say this person's appropriate to receive Prilosec or something. I mean, and then they're writing a prescription, and then they're charging their insurance a bunch of money for it, and then they're filling the prescription. How much labor is the human doing in that piece? Not much. Often those medicines are over the counter, and so it's a little bit of a shell game anyway. I don't support AI prescribing anytime soon, but when you start to, again, looking at the whole picture, when you start to compare it to what we're allowing companies to make billions of dollars doing, for prescribers that are sitting at home, how different is that? I don't know.
Well said. Well, anyway, with that very optimistic note,
always, that's all you get from me is optimism.
We'll wrap it there, but thank you so much, Graham, for joining us. We'll have to have you back soon as we're all trying to figure out what's going to happen next with healthcare and AI.
Anytime. Thanks for having me, guys.
Thanks, Graham.